Welcome to the forum on President Carter's speech. Rudy Edmonds is going to lead us off with a summary statement and comments on it. And then we'll open it to the floor for questions, comments.
Very good, Jane. Thank you. I think by way of introduction, I'd just like to say just a word about it. And this is a speech that really deals with energy and the economy and much more, really. So it's not just energy that Carter talked about. And it really marks a new approach for Carter. He's trying to change a whole pattern. He's asked for the resignation of his cabinet and already has accepted resignations of, I think, five, maybe six. Yeah. Already. And so this is really a turning point. Time magazine shows this as a very sober president with a banner across it, Crossroads. And it is Crossroads in many respects. There are theological overtones to the things that he had to say. And I think as we listen and try to understand the content of this speech, which in my mind is a very important one, I think we ought to think of it in terms really of our Christian background, and particularly Christian stewardship as an American citizen. And if we put this in this framework and then try to analyze what our president is trying to tell us, then let's have a forum about it and deal with the subject, the content of it. Now, I'm going to try and summarize what he said on the tape, which some of you have heard, in 72 minutes. I hope I can do it all in five. Yes. So let me just give you the high points of what he really, did say, and what the importance of it might be then is what we want to talk about. Number one, he says we have a crisis in confidence. There is a crisis in the United States in terms of trusting people. We just don't trust people anymore. And there's a real crisis in who you can believe, who you cannot believe. And so this, he feels, is really causing a loss of unity of purpose. And so we're not together. We don't believe one another. There's a need for faith. He said, we've got to have faith in each other, in what we're doing, and our ability to govern ourselves. And that's a very important point that he makes. And next point is that energy shortage is a real test. That the energy problem is maybe the turning point that might unite us as a country. He says, this is one of the things that maybe can bring us back together, and it'll be a real test of our ability to unite. Now, then he dealt with the energy crisis per se. And he says, I want you to know it's real. It's real. And he's been a long time in really getting at this. But he says it's real, it's worldwide, it's factual. Believe me. He said. Then he outlined 6 points for his program to save oil. Number one, and I'll give you the 6 points and kind of log them in your mind, and then we can repeat any of these that you want to call up afterwards. Use no more energy and foreign oil than we imported in 1977. And that is roughly 8.5 million barrels per day that we imported in 1977. Now, we would import more this year if he did not set quotas. But he has set quotas beginning as of last Sunday night. And the quotas are being reduced. So we will not import any more than we did in 1977. By 1990, we will cut oil imports by half. This is his goal. So instead of what we're getting, 8.5 billion barrels, it will not be more than say 4.5 billion barrels, or approximately that. And that's within a decade, by 1990. 10 years, we've got to come to that point. Now, point number two, set 1979 and 1980 import quotas below the 8.5 million barrels a day, which he agreed to at the Tokyo conference of just a month ago. And so this is point number two, is to reduce them right now and for next year. Point number three, funds. Deals with the funds. He's really has a program outlined here that will cost $140+ billion in the next 10 to 15 years as we go through. He says the $140 billion will come from the windfall profits tax, which he is asking Congress to approve. And that will have some very rocky sledding in the Senate. The $140 billion will be spent to create synthetic fuels to add to our domestic oil supply. And the synthetic fuels will come from coal, from oil shale, from solar, and the biomass conversion. And in order to handle this, he is asking that we set up an energy security corporation, which is a separate and new whatever you want to call it, bureaucracy to handle it. But that's what he's calling for, and he's calling for this to be separate from anything we have to do now. And the energy office that he has just recently created, you see, with Schlesinger as the head of it, and he has fired Schlesinger, you see. And that's already happened.
Rudy, do you have some news like tonight that there are five or six? Yeah. The latest paper is only one, and that's Califano. Only one resignation has been accepted. They all turned them in.
Right. Califano, Blumenthal, who are the others?
No. Brock Adams.
Brock Adams.
Schlesinger.
Schlesinger.
And Bell.
And Bell.
Okay.
Bell. That's
they were all accepted as of when?
And the
well,
rest.
It must have been today.
Yeah, it was today.
All right. Thank
so
you.
It's right up to date. Now, also he proposes creating a solar bank. And in connection with solar, he says that by, he has said in one of his speeches now, that we will be relying on solar for 20% of our total energy by the year 2000. And this is a very optimistic and a very large order that can be carried out. All right, point number four, public utilities to cut the use of oil by 50%. So if your electricity is coming from the use of oil, this has to be cut, and presumably coal will take over the 50% cut. And coal then, this has to be done within 10 years. That's in the next decade. So that's what he has said is his goal. Point number five, Congress to establish an energy mobilization board. And that mobilization board is to cut through all kinds of red tape that stands in the way of getting energy projects approved and online. And an example of that would be the pipeline from California to Texas, you know, that was stymied for 5 years and finally canceled. And this kind of thing, he says, cannot continue in the future. So he says we will pay attention to the environment, but we have some things that have to be more important than some of the things that have held things up. Number six, we must have a bold conservation program, and he describes it as bold. So that remains to be seen. One of the things under that, he's calling for availability of funds to loan the poor who cannot pay the price of the new oil that's going to be going up. And gasoline rationing is one thing he's called for, and he's asked Congress to approve that and give him that before they recess the first week in August, which is 3 weeks away. So that's in the board. And he's calling for more public transportation. And the bottom line of all of this is, what can we do? Carter says, and I quote, every American must stop wasting energy. And that's where he puts it. Now, in Kansas City, the next morning, he made another speech that followed up pretty much the same point. But he added to that, that the oil companies, he, as you know, he does not trust the oil companies. And he is calling for the Justice Department to really investigate everything that relates to energy, particularly oil and so on. And he wants an Energy Information Institute with total monitoring and a total reporting of this on a weekly basis. He said this kind of information ought to be reported to you in the same way that the weather is. And so you know what the energy situation is from week to week, and he's calling for a separate accounting and this kind of thing, which will be another layer of bureaucracy to monitor what's going on in the in that particular area. Now, my own impression of this, I think it's a very important and a very dynamic speech, and I think I have heard all of Carter's energy talks, and I think this is the best one. And he has definitely outlined a program, which is the first time really he has put down exactly what he wants and when he wants it. So now we know where things are, at least as far as he's concerned. And in my judgment, he is very definitely on target. And it's the kind of thing that we should expect our leadership to produce as a president of the United States. It was dramatic. He got the attention of the American people by going to the mountaintop. He went to Camp David, and he stayed there for 12 days, in and out. But he listened to every segment of the American public, and he then synthesized this in his own mind, and the reason apparently he canceled the 2 weeks ahead address was that he simply didn't think anybody would listen to him. And that's exactly what's happened. People have not listened to Carter. Now, from my own point, I'm also critical. I think that Carter is long on good speeches and very short on good actions. Now, this is his chance, I think, to turn that around. And it sounds like, and everything indicates that he means business. And I hope he does. And if that's the case, I think we really have something to look forward to that may really get us back on track. People haven't been listening to Carter. The crisis, in my judgment, will probably have to get worse before people will listen. I doubt that we are ready in this room to really listen to this seriously. And I doubt that Congress is ready to enact what he has asked for simply because they are afraid of what you think. And that's where it is with the public. And so we can expect then things to happen in the economy. And I think that rather than for me to comment about that, I'd rather hear Jan say something about what he thinks this all means in terms of our economy. Then let's have a good dialogue about what this all means.
Jan, would you like to come here?
Yeah. Probably you all heard that I think I mentioned our society. It's sort of an economic society, and so it should come as no surprise to many of you that I think that the energy problem is lock, stock, and barrel, and no pun intended there, an economic problem. That is, we will run out of oil a lot quicker if gas is 50 cents a gallon than if it's $2 a gallon. And that we've already seen with the action that they have taken in Europe, where the gasoline has been for a long time much more expensive. And so I think that until the price of oil becomes much more expensive, that America will not really cut back any more than we have to on our consumption of gasoline. I do not think we'll respond to this until it really hits our pocketbook. And I'm not sure that Carter is really ready to do that. Although the rationing to the 77 import of oil will undoubtedly increase the price of gas, and that will to some extent cut back our consumption of gas and oil and so on. It's a well-known fact that other industrial countries that produce per capita GNP in the same amounts that we do, have higher per capita standard of living, use 50% of the gas to produce of energy to produce a dollar's worth of GNP. They are twice as energy efficient as we are, because the price structure in those countries have always reflected the relative price of oil. In this country, it has not. So I do not think we'll respond until the price of oil, until the price of gas starts climbing. Secondly, Carter made some remarks regarding the balanced budget. Given the rate of inflation that we're suffering in this country, it's entirely possible that this is one goal he'll achieve by 1981-82 anyway. That is, the rate of inflation, wages and prices will keep increasing. If we do not change the tax structure, we'll all be in a higher income tax bracket. And if we even moderately cut back on government expenditure, the estimated revenue will balance the budget by about 1982. So if we even cut back a little bit, we will lick that problem in inflation. And then he said, by importing as much oil as we are really importing inflation. And that's true to the extent that the price of oil and the price of energy is increasing at a faster rate than sort of the normal rate of inflation in this country. And so we are, to some extent, increasing inflation. In 1978, this country had a $27 billion trade deficit. $19 billion of that $27 billion was oil. Yeah. So it's a significant energy problem, it's a significant economic problem, and I don't see us doing a whole lot about it until it really hits us where it hurts. In America, that's the pocketbook.
Thank you, Jan. As a way of proceeding, let me ask first for questions of clarification first on the speech. Perhaps you need to just clarify some of the points that Rudy has made so we're clear on the content as we can be of what has been said by the President.
Say, Rudy?
Yeah.
I've got a question up here. I think some of the terminology when I listened to Carter's speech was kind of in reflection of some of the action that was taken during World War II, establishment of a commission during World War II that regulated just about every product that went out of this country or was produced by this country, in the same way he wants to establish kind of an energy commission that would do the same thing. Also, creating another level of bureaucracy, I think, is kind of a editorial opinion of this new energy agency that he's talking about. Everyone knows that the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation is a similar corporation that Carter would be trying to establish, only using energy rather than dollars. And that's kind of a totally independent run thing, but it is a real watchdog on our whole economy, as probably Jen at stake.
Yes, I think the point is well made, and the thing that you can kind of think is a parallel to this was the problem we had in World War II with rubber. And synthetic rubber, you see, became the product that's all we know today. You know, so he's saying, well, at that time we had to have a synthetic. Rubber was the case. Today we have to have a synthetic, which is synthetic fuel. And so why can't we do the same kinds of things? We don't have to reinvent the wheel.
Questions of clarification? Here, please.
Yeah, initially when you talked about the crisis in confidence, he went over some other things relating to what had led us to this point. I wish you would kind of paraphrase that too. Okay.
The things that led us to the point of lack of confidence.
Yeah.
Well, it was a series of things, obviously. It's questioning the government, it's Watergate, it's the kinds of things that have given us lack of confidence. It's the feeling generally that we're being ripped off. There's a feeling in terms of the public not really being law conscious. We don't respect authority anymore, and we have problems with many moral issues. In other words, it's just the fabric of the whole American Republic that he feels has gotten soft. And we don't have confidence in what we're hearing about really anything.
He had gone back a little farther in history in the 60s, talking about other things which had led to this too. I wasn't quite sure how they were connected, not just Watergate, but also the assassinations of the 60s too.
Yeah, he mentioned the assassination of Kennedy. This is really where it started.
I do have the text here.
Good.
And let me just give you the key sentence that he spends the first half of his speech on this. Content-wise, first half goes to the crisis. In a nation that was proud of hard work, strong families, close-knit communities, and our faith in God, too many of us now tend to worship self-indulgence and consumption. Human identity is no longer defined by what one does, but what one owns. But we've discovered that owning things and consuming things does not satisfy our longing for meaning. Then he goes on, two-thirds of the people do not even vote. Productivity of American workers drops. Willingness of American workers to save for the future has fallen below all of the other people in the Western world. I mean, it's disrespect for government, for churches, for schools, news media, and other institutions. We were sure that ours was a nation of the ballot, not the bullet, until the murders of John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King Jr. We talked that our armies were invincible, then we suffered the agonies of Vietnam. Respect to the president. I mean, it just goes on.
Read that whole sentence, because he says more than that.
On the Kennedys?
Yeah, no, right after the Kennedys.
Okay, well, let me start with that. We were sure that ours was a nation of the ballot, not of the bullets, until the murders of John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King Jr. We were taught that our armies were always invincible and our causes were always just, only to suffer the agony of Vietnam. We respected the presidencies of place of honor until the shock of water. Resources limitless. I mean, just on and on. Category after category.
One thing that you didn't mention when you talked about alternative energy sources was that in Kansas City, he talked about 5 or 10 minutes about nuclear. And I think this was really the first time in a major speech since Three Mile Island that he reasserted his commitment to nuclear energy. And we talked about how Chicago gets well over 50% of their power, and that we've learned a lot from Three Mile Island. And I think that might be a point for discussion as well. He really sounded to me like he was coming on very strongly that was going to be one of the major
alternative sources of power. It's an important point. He purposely left it out Sunday, and then he put it in on Monday morning at Kansas City. I'm sure it was part of the total, because he said that his whole position would be in three speeches. One Sunday night in Washington, D.C., then Kansas City, and then in Detroit. And we do get 18% of our electricity from atomic plants now. And he made the point then that this has to continue.
Further questions or clarification?
Returning to this point on the crisis of confidence, Rudy, you stated that he distrusts the oil companies. I'm not sure that was in his speech, but if that's the case, I wonder if any of his proposals would permit a restoration of confidence by the people in the oil companies.
Well, do you have, I don't know, you may have the text of what he said there, but he said in effect, we expect the oil companies to cooperate. And he said that there has been a dragging of feet. This is the way he put it. And particularly from the point of view of the Alaska pipeline for the gas. And here, and he's called for a conference in his own, in Washington, D.C., of all the people who are involved in the development of the North Slope in terms of the gas getting to the United States.
Didn't he also, Rudy, say that he would appoint, or they had already appointed, an additional 300 independent auditors that would pour over the books of the oil companies to ascertain whether or not there was a created or a real shortage?
I think he said 400.
400. So he realizes that there are a lot of people who do not believe that there is a crisis, and maybe this is one way, you know, by getting the government, independent auditor, and an accounting firm, he said.
And I think you should know, as a part of my background, I have worked for major oil companies and so on for 18 years of my professional life, and so naturally I have some insight into what this is. I hope what this means is that this investigation will really clear the air, and that the oil companies will not come off, as they have up to the present, as the scapegoat for this whole thing. And if we can just clear the air, and it can be told that there isn't this kind of graft that people think. In other words, your neighbor, and maybe you, think that you're just being ripped off by oil companies. I personally do not think that is the case. I'm not whitewashed. The oil companies, I'd say they're businessmen like any other kind of business, but they don't make any more profit than the average business, and I think that the business is not any worse. In fact, I think it comes off as being very much the average kind of thing you expect in any kind of business. Now, maybe that's part of our lack of confidence. You see, it's not only the oil companies, but it's other companies as well, and the tax problems and all of these things that we think that we're being ripped off by major corporations. And this is kind of the tone of the American public. And I hope this will clarify. And I think the oil companies would welcome an audit if they can get cleaned reporting back to the people of exactly what they find. Because the best information is that there is no problem. Newsweek dealt with this very extensively in an issue here about 6 weeks ago.
Rudy, why did he fire why did he ask for resignations from cabinet members?
I think he has to establish a new pattern. Now, I'm not a political scientist, so I think I really am not qualified to answer that. But I see Carter really against the wall, and he has to prove something at this point. I think, and the only way I think he can do it is simply, well, he can't quit himself, so what else can he do? You know, the team isn't performing. That's his way of casting it off, in a way.
Rudy?
Yeah.
I think there's been a lot of criticism that there were people in the cabinet that didn't support his views. Mm-hmm. And so that, you know, a lot of politicians were asking, well, why do you keep people in your cabinet that are supposed to be the closest advisors if they're not part of the team? So I think this was the reason given in most cases for asking for all resignations and then inviting only a portion of them back.
I must tell you, I was out on Monday and I picked up a paper, and I had to find this, but there was a cartoon. This was before any of the firing took place. And the cartoon said Jimmy's fervent in prayer on his knees and saying, Lord, give me a sign. And the voice speaks saying, fire Schlesinger.
Yeah.
And any sign, Jimmy goes on in his prayer, give me any sign, and in a loud voice, fire Schlesinger. And then Jimmy looks in, at you and says, anyone knows the devil can throw his voice. But I think that's symptomatic. All I want to say is I think that's symptomatic of a lot of I think that it was symptomatic though of a lot of the pressure that was building. A lot of pressure building on Carter to do something, as the point is made about the cabinet.
I think maybe one of the things we could discuss is our willingness to cut back,
right.
Our own personal willingness to do that.
Let's hold that just for a moment to see if there are further questions of clarification. Just so we know what we're best informed as we can be on the content.
Now, Rudy, we thought when we came out, we heard that there was an energy savings bond plan that was to involve the American nation in making an investment similar to the war savings bond plan.
That's right. Apparently that is, I don't know that he can do this by presidential edict, or really has to get Congress to approve. Anybody know? I don't know, but he is asking for
it. Questions on clarification.
Go into effect fairly rapidly, if depending on what okay it needed.
Yeah.
Are there further questions of clarification? Over
yeah,
here.
What he's saying is that our future is in the development of further coal resources, domestic coal.
Alternative sources to cut back, so we can cut back on foreign imports. But he also says that, you know, there just isn't enough oil, and our consumption is to the point where there must be a going right with this, a massive, bold conservation program. In other words, we've got to cut back consumption and then to build in synthetic sources to add to our dwindling supply. You may not realize that the domestic reserves of this country have gone down steadily from 1970 through 78. Every year we have not been able to replace the oil, the domestic oil that we have used since 1970 was when we passed the turning point of the curve.
I think coal does play a key role in that transition period. I think he does focus on that in the text rather clearly. There's a question over here.
Well, it seemed to me that I didn't hear the speech, but I did hear a news clip commenting on, or a part of his Kansas City speech. And it seemed to me that he was taking a lot firmer stance than he ever has in the past, because am I not right? Has anybody else heard this? It seemed to me that he was saying that if he didn't get the cooperation of the people and of the oil companies, that he would use his presidential powers to make sure that some of this stuff got
That's
done.
Exactly the implication.
And he wasn't wishy-washy like it. Sometimes he's not really.
He has said it forthright this time. Now the question is it rhetoric or is it action?
But the only thing he has the power to do is to limit the importation of oil. He can set those quotas, but that's about all he can really do. The rest
is Congress.
Further, are there any other questions of clarification? We can move on.
Yeah, I'd like to know, does anyone here know what is the percentage of our oil import that is used privately as opposed to industrial or commercial?
It's about a third, a third, a third. The industrial is at least a third, 35 to 38% industrial. And the private runs close to 30. Automobiles, biggest part of that. And then other things making up the balance.
I have a question. You had said that we were going to cut our public utilities by 50% and coal was going to be taking over. Okay, did he talk about, is he including the environmental costs? I mean, coal is extremely dirty.
No, that's one of the things that he didn't comment on it, but he said that we've got to turn to coal. Now, that means environmental problems and very serious ones. And he says that we can't let the environment, in a sense, I'm editorializing, but what I read is that he says we've got to go to coal in spite of the environmental problem. The utilities have to go to coal, at least 50%.
I think that you're putting words in his mouth that he didn't say.
Pardon?
He didn't say that. He said explicitly that the environmental concerns were very important and would be kept in mind and would be paid attention to.
That's right.
I think what you're saying might be right, but he didn't specifically say that. In no way did he put himself in the position of saying, Chuck, environment, we're going.
No, he didn't say that.
But, just to make
it
clear.
What it would cost us, though.
He did imply that.
He did say specifically, 50% within 10 years. Right. Now that means a lot more coal than we're using now.
Okay, Jan, how is that included in our cost of? I mean, how are we going to be able to include, if we can, environmentally, you know, have environmental protection? That's expensive.
That's right.
Okay, so that would be the cost that we pay for the energy.
Yeah. Somehow that has to be internalized. And we don't have good mechanisms for doing that. But all of life is choice, you know, and it's one choice or the other, environmental pollution or less energy, or more energy and more pollution.
Of course, it's more of a trade-off.
Pardon?
Is it more of a trade-off, though, of less dependence on foreign nations running our capability of producing over against the environmental damage that may cause? I think it's more of a, where Carter's coming from is more of a concern for national security than a concern, well, we have to protect ourselves first and then we'll start on the environment after that. Would that be a correct way of interpreting that?
Let me read to the 1.5. To make absolutely certain that nothing stands in the way of achieving these goals, I will urge Congress to create an Energy Mobilization Board, which, like the War Production Board in World War II, will have the responsibility and authority to cut through the red tape, the delays, and the endless roadblocks to completing key energy projects. Now, that's loaded. That could mean so many things. In the next sentence, he says, we will protect our environment. Now, I mean, I think he's posed a very key tension without spelling it out, and I think we have to let it stand at that. May I ask that, because there are so many that are interested, that we proceed by raised hands, and way back I saw one.
Oh, okay. I was just going to comment. There's another factor involved in this conversion of coal, and that's a matter of transportation. This has been going on for a number of years. San Antonio, Texas, which is about the 15th largest city in the country now, is sitting very near natural gas and has been generating its electricity from natural gas primarily. By federal mandate, whatever agency, they have shifted to coal. Texas has nothing but lignite, low-grade lignite so far. The coal is hauled in from Montana. Now that's does not make any kind of economic sense. The cost of power production in San Antonio is very, very high. But now this, I think, is one of the real things we have to be aware of, that national policies, which make sense, have to have a little bit of geographic understanding and their application. Because if you say shift to coal and you tell San Antonio shift to coal, that makes no sense. You tell Montana shift
it,
to coal, yeah.
You know, Evelyn, it may, though. It may from a lot of standpoints. From one standpoint, pollution. It may be that Texas can stand a little more pollution than some other places. And you know, it may be that we're going to have to pay the price. Nationally, we're going to have to pay the price of doing that. We have started doing that with pollution. We are allowing companies and utilities to buy the right to pollute from other companies. Just so that total pollution in a region is at a certain area, which is one of the better ways of handling the whole pollution problem. And it may be that that's better. So that's another part of the whole problem, and we may have to face that. And
who are economically disadvantaged are bearing the burden of that. That's the problem.
Well, yeah, it, but that may be efficient from the you know, from the standpoint of aggregate pollution and aggregate economic issues.
Are there any other questions or clarification?
Montana late night makes no smoke.
Much better than Hawaii.
Well, let me mention one other factor in conversion, and that is the cost of boilers. You don't burn coal in the same things that you burn oil and gas. And just the steel and the metals and the energy to make the new steel, the new metals, to make the conversion, must all be added into a net energy equation that is going to make it very difficult. We're short of metals. And all of this, you know, we that's on the side. But that's just as much a shortage area as oil.
Okay.
How soon did Carter want to see 20% of our energy coming from solar energy?
By the year 2000.
Are we ready to move beyond?
Yeah, let's move in any way you choose to move now.
I just want to say that the two things that bothered me most about his speech were that he talked several points about cutting back. He said we must cut back on the waste of fuel. He emphasized waste. But, you know, there just were no specifications on that. That always sounds good. Everybody's willing to trim off the extra, you know. Everybody will admit you can live a little less. He did not say we're going to have to learn to use less. He did say back in April, though, in what I thought was really a point of speech, I think this is almost the exact quote, he said, we're going to have to learn that we must use less energy and pay more for what we use.
Right.
He said that then, but I don't hear him now stressing so much that we're going to have to use less. He's relying on the fact that we have to trim the waste, and that still is kind of ambiguous. The other thing he said that had no substance to it, I didn't think, was he kept harping that we must win the war on the energy battlefield. But again, that's so ambiguous. That sort of leaves me up in the air. What does that mean? I mean, who's going to put specifications on when we win and how far do you go until you win and what troops are fighting at? Those were the two areas I felt up in the air about.
I think his answer, I'm guessing, would be if we are united in the fact that we get the country together on the energy program to lick it, then he would think we would have won. We got together and put a man on the moon. You know, that kind of thing.
Point six does seem to me say what you're getting at. I'm proposing a bold conservation program to involve every state, county, and city, and every average American in our energy battle. This effort will permit you to build conservation into your homes and your lives at a cost you can afford. He's saying it without the clarity that he said it, I think.
Also, he said that public utilities would have to give low interest loans payable only at the time of sale of the house to help on the local level conservation in homes, such as, don't they have a program in the Northwest like that?
Yeah, Portland, Oregon has one, yes.
That's just one.
Up here?
For the
Yes. Comment. I think a lot of his speech is heavily emphasis on two things. One is conservation, and two is the development of technology for new ways of developing and harnessing energy. We can talk about shipping coal down to San Antonio or wherever it was. I know for a fact in western North Dakota, sitting under the largest lignite field in the world, within boundaries. There's currently, I think, two coal gasification plants that are going up, which will take coal and convert it into gasoline. That type of technology, the expansion of solar energy, development of stuff just that need the money for grant funding, I think is a real heavy part of this speech that, like you said, is probably going to take about $140 million just to do pull it off.
Yeah. Carter did not speak to the further development of oil, for example, offshore oil sites have been mentioned in the past frequently, and I understand there's been extensive drilling done in that area. Yet on the other hand, we find very large companies like Exxon investing their monies, not in the development or pursuit of additional oil sites or reserves, but in companies that aren't directly involved in the development of oil. For example, Exxon recently purchased Reliance Electric Company for $427 million. And one would wonder perhaps if Exxon couldn't better serve the interests of this country by taking that money and pursuing more aggressively the development of additional oil sites.
Well, it's not only Exxon. Mobil bought Montgomery Ward, Atlantic Richfield has taken over the copper industries, and so you can go on down the line. Why have they done it? They can make more money in other industries than in their own. The oil industry is not as profitable as these others. Otherwise, they would have their money invested in their own business. And I think that makes very good economic sense.
But Rudy, I always get the feeling that we're paying more for oil because they want it to reinvest to find more oil for us. And then when they buy Ringling Brothers Barnes Daily Circus or show a 400% profit in a quarter, that's why I feel like I'm getting ripped off. I don't understand the economics.
Yeah, well, the 400% is a false figure, you know, to begin with. It compares with a company that had almost no, I think you're referring to Sohio Petroleum Company. And I used to work for Sohio. And I know the 400% that you refer to. It refers to the difference between the delivery of oil from the Alaska North Slope and no delivery. So the year before, they had no oil from Alaska. The current quarter that you're referring to, they had almost 1 million barrels a day. Now, obviously, the figures are going to be very different. But they spent almost $10 billion to get that oil from Alaska to where they could sell it in that particular quarter. All of that has to be paid back. And that's the part of the economics the American public just doesn't understand. There's a long lead time and a long line of expenditures before you ever get a field on production. You got to buy the leases, you got to do all of the things, and build the refineries and the pipelines, and then you can compare one quarter with another, but without the background, means nothing. And this is what the American public really has been fed by the newspaper. That's part of the problem. Do you agree?
Yeah. Profit in highly capital-intensive industries tends to be much more cyclical than in other industries. It goes up and down. It's 2% 1 year, 12% the next year, 20%, then down to 3%. And so what we have to do is look at an average. And you know, if your profits can increase from 10,000 to a few hundred thousand, and it'll increase by 400%. But there has been some excess profits in the oil companies in the last few years. That's very clear. And there will be in the next year.
And the windfall tax, of course, will take that from the oil companies and put it into synthetics. Now maybe that's a better place for it. And that's the thing that the American people has to decide. That's what Congress has to decide. Now, if the American oil companies do not have those profits, they cannot put them back into their own development or buy Montgomery Ward or anything else. That money will go then to producing synthetics. And the real problem is keeping the current domestic production at somewhere near the present level, and we are not now charging, that is, Congress is protecting you as the consumer and not allowing the oil companies to get more than $10 a barrel for old oil. That's oil discovered before 1974. Now, that means that they're not getting the price of the replacement cost of that barrel. Now, that again, is poor economics. From if you really want more oil, then you really ought to have more profits to put into oil. And I think where the windfall profit tax will probably come out in Congress. And it's really under fire because it means this kind of taking it away from one thing and putting it into something else. The problems will relate to really how effectively or how effective you can be in doing that sort of thing, and whether you really want the current domestic production to continue to slide. Now, the other thing they can do is simply say it very simply. All right, you've made extra profit. Now, if you can show us, and we can be convinced, that you spend or you are spending that money in developing domestic production, then the tax is forgiven. You know, you get the benefit of that. If you don't spend it, if you spend it some other way, then you owe us the tax. Now, I would favor that kind of a windfall profits tax. I agree. But I think the profits ought to go back into finding oil. But I think you ought to take off the restrictions off of the price of oil so that replacement costs can be accomplished. And make it reasonable to do that.
Yeah. On like Brock Adams, am I not correct that their disagreement was over mass transit? And wasn't Brock Adams in favor of like more railroads, or am I wrong? Isn't it kind of counterproductive to have 0.6 or whatever on mass, or whatever the point was, and then fire the one person where the disagreement was over mass transport?
Yeah, I think Werner has an answer to that.
Well, I think that was part of it, but I think they're at about the same time as these changes took place. Carter also elevated Hamilton Jordan, chief of staff. There was some real objections. Like Brock Adams came out, was really forced to say it publicly by the news media, that he would not report directly to Jordan or to Hamilton Jordan, but he thought that he should report directly to the president. And I think then this was sort of his death sentence right there. And I think some of the other cabinet members that were fired felt somewhat the same way. And so I think that was as much it as maybe the mass transit thing.
That will be an interesting thing on the American public. In Time magazine, with Carter's confidence on the line, Hamilton Jordan just got a boot on his car, which is a very large white Chrysler, and $110 worth of tickets. And yeah, sure, you laugh at the whole business of having confidence when Carter promised us all he would never have a position of joint of the chief of staff of the White House. And that white Chrysler is going to do him more harm than all of his pious rhetoric.
That's right.
There it is, right there.
There it is. Here's the picture of it. It's got a boot on it.
President Carter, I believe, asked Brock Adams to stay on. And Brock Adams, D.C., he can't drive it anywhere. Has he resigned? Because President Carter asked Adams to stay on.
Well, that's what I thought. They said no.
Well, that's on. Werner, did you hear the comment?
No, I didn't.
Please, could we listen carefully?
President Carter asked Brock Adams to stay on. Now, that was in Tuesday's paper I read, and Brock Adams was going to make a decision. He said, which depended, it hung on to a subway decision, a decision by the president regarding the subways, whether he would be funded, I believe, for subways in Boston.
Well, on the news tonight, it just mentioned, and Tom Foley, who's one of our other congressmen from this area, also stated that he thought it was too bad that Brock Adams was fired. And earlier in the newscast, it mentioned the same thing, that Brock Adams was not invited to stay on. And that's how it was put.
Brock Adams did very recently lose that Amtrak through Battery.
Yeah, right now. We are at the 10 o'clock hour, and I simply want to say, again, I think it's important to note that he spent the first half of his speech analyzing the condition of the our condition, then went on to propose ways of dealing with that condition. I guess, Walter, are you going to speak to that?
Yes. I wanted to address myself to the rhetoric in the speech, or to the part that maybe we haven't paid too much attention to. One is Carter's diagnosis, that we are in what he calls a crisis in confidence, but he repeatedly referred to it as a kind of spiritual crisis. And secondly, that he made an appeal to what he called sort of the time-honored values and traditions of America. I think first of all, Carter is right that the crisis is spiritual, but I think that it's been coming on a long time, and I think that the appeal to the so-called time-honored values of America are counterproductive, because those time-honored values really were essentially the values of limitless growth, and that we could do anything we wanted to, that we could afford anything we wanted to, that we could buy the world if we wanted to, or conquer it if we had to. That is the time-honored value of American civilization. And what we are discovering at the present time is that we are not able to buy, conquer, burn, or destroy whatever we want to do, that there are limits to what we can waste, and that finally judgment is coming upon us for all of this. So I guess, first of all, an appeal to the time-honored values really doesn't make much sense at all, because it's precisely those values that have to be turned around if we're going to be able to deal with the crisis. His rhetoric for dealing with it is winning a war on energy. I think that's disastrous rhetoric. I don't think that that's the kind of rhetoric that will be at all helpful. It seems to me that the occasion for us in this room may well be to ask different kinds of questions. I guess I'm impressed by the fact that we have not cultivated a national ethos, and I know it particularly in the educational scene, but in the universities, colleges of this country, we have not cultivated a national ethos which gives us the kind of resources that make it possible for us to confront the diminution of our lifestyle, the depression of our lifestyle, the reduction in lifestyle that is really called for. We have created, in fact, I think right now, educational institutions that are deprived of an insight into the nature of the human problem, deprived of insight into the kind of values which our culture has wrongly cultivated, deprived of insight into the kind of values that we need to have. We were just talking, was it at the supper table or the dinner table today? Okay, we were just talking today about the fact that literature in our society today is not taught for the insights that one can gain from that literature. We have studiously avoided in our whole educational enterprise learning anything from our literature. We look at our literary tradition as if it were fossilized. We do not really think that when our literature talks about God that it really means God, or when it talks about judgment that it really means judgment, or that one can pay attention to these kinds of things. We have created Towers of Babel on our university campuses today, where we are really not allowed, almost by definition, to consider the kinds of questions and problems that this crisis confronts us with. And Exhibit A, for me, always remains the fact that in the university system of the state of California, Ernest Becker, Denial of Death Becker, Angel in Armor Becker, a man of prodigious insight, was not able to get tenure from the California university system, because, among other things, he was recommending religious readings to his students. Because, among other things, he was ranging across disciplines, sociology, philosophy,
psychology, anthropology, and wasn't confining himself to the narrow but irrelevant learning, which now is cultivated as the height of a discipline. I think that's where the crisis lies. I think Carter's rhetoric is important, but I think right in the sense that it is a deep crisis of spirit, wrong in the appeal to traditional American values, totally incapable, I think, of meeting the situation. I think.